many Facebook users do I have in here? A few? You know, the thing about Facebook, for those of you that maybe aren't on it, it's a social media platform, and you can have people request to be friends with you. And then you get a choice. You can either say, yes, I confirm that, or to click it and ignore it. And then you get to find out that as they post things, you get to keep up with them that way, or you can post things that they can see. And there's a lot of stuff on it I don't much care for. It is a handy way for us to keep track of our children, and especially a means of communicating with the folks in the Philippines. And I, it seems like every day I get another friend request. And sometimes that's a friend request to somebody I know, and I go, oh, cool, and confirm it, or, oh, yeah, I don't want to be his friend, ignore it. And sometimes I get friend requests from people I have no idea in the world who they are. What would happen if a friend request popped up, though, and it said, you have a friend request from Jesus? Now you have a choice to make. Do you confirm that, or do you ignore it? And then once perhaps you confirm it, there's another feature to Facebook. You know, down the road, you can say, you know, I don't want to hear from that person anymore, and you can delete them as a friend. See, it's a question, perhaps, of loyalty. And that's kind of what we're going to look at today. We're going to look at this passage of Mark. And I want us to be thinking about loyalty as we do this. So what does loyalty mean to you? Well, one definition is that it is a faithful adherence to a sovereign, a government, a leader, a cause, etc. And that always leads to, in my mind, to another question. To whom or what are you granting that loyalty? And then perhaps another question might be, to what degree is that loyalty granted? And perhaps even another question might be, what motivates that loyalty? As we go through today's passage, let's evaluate some of the individuals in regard to those questions. Now, for those of you that maybe have missed a week or two, or perhaps are visiting, or perhaps for those of you that are getting a shade more senile and have forgotten, we're going to have a quick review of this book of Mark. And you might ask, how is Mark different from the other Gospels? Well, for one thing, Mark is much more concise. It's the shortest of the Gospels. He doesn't go into a lot of details of Jesus' life. For instance, he doesn't mention the birth, and actually a lot of that time frame. He doesn't start his gospel until we get to John the Baptist actually baptizing Jesus. That's where Mark picks it up. And Mark's gospel portrays Jesus as constantly on the move. The forward motion in Mark's writing leaps the knowledgeable reader's mind continually, looking ahead to the cross and the resurrection. 39 times Mark uses the word immediately, giving us a sense that Jesus' time on earth was short, and that there was much to accomplish in his few years of ministry. Again, Mark really emphasizes Jesus' ministry. And while Matthew's gospel portrays Jesus as the king, Mark reveals him as God's servant. Jesus' work was always for a larger purpose, a point emphasized in Mark 10:45. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Mark filled his gospel with the miracles of Jesus, illustrating again and again both the power and the compassion of the Son of God. In these passages, Mark revealed more than Jesus as a good teacher who offered people spiritual renewal, but the book also portrays Jesus as the true God and the true man, a point Gary made last week. See, Jesus reached into the lives of people and affected physical and circumstantial change. But Jesus' life as an agent of change wasn't without an ultimate purpose. Amid his hands-on ministry, Jesus constantly pointed to the definitive way in which he would serve humanity. His death on the cross and his resurrection from the dead. It's only through faith in these works of Jesus Christ that human beings find eternal redemption for their whole selves. Moreover, Jesus became our model for how to live our lives, serving others as he did. Now, a couple of weeks ago, Frank had us take communion as he told us of that Last Supper. And from that Passover supper where Jesus washed the feet of his disciples, Gary last week took us to the Garden of Gethsemane where Jesus went after his last Passover meal to pray. His disciples accompanied him, and he asked them to keep watch while he prayed. We saw Jesus pour his heart out. He knows what awaits him. And Jesus, the man, would liken out. If it be your will, take this cup from me. But Jesus, his fully divine nature, accepts the Father's will. And that's his focus. But not my will, Lord, but yours. It lets us know where his loyalties lie. During his prayer time, he repeatedly stopped and came to his disciples and found them sleeping instead of praying and keeping watch. Verses 40 through 42 that Gary ended with last week in the 14th chapter of Mark says, when he returned to them again, he found them sleeping, for they couldn't keep their eyes open, and they didn't know what to say. Then he returned to them the third time, and he said, go ahead and sleep. Have your rest. But know, the time has come. The Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Up, let's be going. My betrayer is here. And that's where we pick up the narrative today. We're looking really from the time of the betrayal right up to the time of crucifixion today. We're looking from the time of betrayal to the point where Pilate turns Jesus over to the soldiers for crucifixion. And as we take a look at this, which I have to tell you, it's been an extremely hard passage. It seems like we almost always kind of skip this part. You know, we want to see Jesus pouring out his heart in Gethsemane, but at the same time, we want to get to that crucifixion and then the resurrection. But there's a lot of gems to be mined here. So as we start this, let's go back to the questions posed a little earlier and evaluate as we go through this passage. What's how some of the folks we talk about fit into these questions. So Mark 14:43, I'll be starting there. And immediately, even as Jesus said this, Judas, one of the 12 disciples, arrived with a crowd of men armed with swords and clubs. They had been sent by the leading priests, the teachers of religious law, and the elders. The traitor, Judas, had given them a prearranged signal. "You will know which one to arrest when I greet him with a kiss. Then you can take him away under guard." And as soon as they arrived, Judas walked up to Jesus. "Rabbi," he exclaimed, and gave him a kiss. Now, a quick look at Judas. Here was a man who had the benefit of walking and learning from Jesus for years. One might compare him to a modern-day person who attends church every Sunday, participates in Bible studies, and maybe even takes an active role in the leadership of the church. But his loyalty isn't wholly to Jesus, but to what he can get out of it. That 30 pieces of gold, the traditional cost of a slave, that's hardly following the servant's example. Then others grabbed Jesus and arrested him. But one of the men with Jesus pulled out his sword and struck the high priest's slave, slashing off his ear. Jesus asked them, "Am I some dangerous revolutionary that you come with swords and clubs to arrest me? Why didn't you arrest me in the temple? I was there among you teaching every day." But these things are happening to fulfill what the scriptures say about me. Then all his disciples deserted him and ran away. One young man following behind was clothed only in a long linen shirt. When the mob tried to grab him, he slipped out of his shirt and ran away naked. Well, let's briefly talk about a few of these folks. The crowd, this is not the same group that hailed Jesus as he made his triumphal entry. The crowd is comprised of antagonistic religious leaders, officers of the Jewish temple, or the temple police if you prefer, and a detachment of Roman soldiers. This detachment was probably around 200. The Jewish leaders had convinced the Roman powers that be that Jesus was a dangerous revolutionary like Barabbas. We'll get to him later. This crowd was well-trained and well-armed. The organizers were the chief priest and the scribes and the elders. Now let me talk a little bit about government at the time. See, this was part of the Roman Empire, and they ruled with a pretty heavy iron hand. However, they realized that it was beneficial to let groups think that they had some self-rule within the empire. So the Jews were allowed to govern themselves as long as they kept Caesar supreme, and there was no attempt to revolt against the Romans. As you might guess then, Rome influenced who might be selected as the chief priest and other leaders to help keep the Jews in line. Yes, politics played a role. And knowing that, you should be able to speculate a little bit about where and why loyalties were laid. Within this Jewish political realm were two main groups, the Sadducees and the Pharisees. And they didn't always see eye to eye, but they were united in wanting to get rid of Jesus. They feared his popularity would spark a revolution, causing Rome to retaliate and thereby placing their delicate positions of authority in jeopardy. They were also a little bit peeved at Jesus because they controlled the temple. And Jesus had forcibly expelled the merchants and the money changers during this busy Passover week. In other words, he was hurting their pocketbooks. They also deeply resented Jesus' public defiance of their unbiblical system of rabbinic tradition. They had their religion, and it was supreme. Their loyalty was to this religion, over God. The religious people wanted Jesus to fit their picture of a Messiah, to fit their religious system. He didn't. Do you ever try to place Jesus into your system rather than you fit into his? I fear there are times when we all do that. Let's talk about the high priest's slave. John identifies the slave as Malchus, and I wonder about him and how his loyalties might have changed. I mean, certainly having an ear cut off might impact you. But then immediately having it put back on, all healed, that would have had to have had him think about his loyalties. This guy's different. Let's move on. So they took Jesus to the high priest's home, where he was leading priests, the elders, and the teachers of religious laws had gathered. Meanwhile, Peter followed them at a distance and went right into the high priest's courtyard. There he sat with his guards, warming himself by the fire. Now, I might mention something at this point. Jesus had to endure more than one trial. And initially, he was taken to the house of Annas, who at one time had been the high priest. And they tried to trick him into saying something, and he really didn't answer them at all. And so the next thing they did was take him to the high priest's house, who happened to be the son-in-law of the previous high priest. Don't think there might have been some collusion here? Probably the two houses were across each other from each other in that courtyard. Well, inside, the leading priest and the entire council were trying to find evidence against Jesus so they could put him to death, but they couldn't find any. Many false witnesses spoke against him, but they contradicted each other. And finally, some men stood up and gave false testimony. In other words, saying they lied. We heard him say, "I will destroy this temple with human hands, and in 3 days I will build another made without human hands." But even then, they didn't get their story straight. There are so many wrong things here. First of all, they are completely ignoring the Mosaic Law. I mean, going all the way back to Deuteronomy, a wonderfully efficient, fair Jewish jurisprudence system was put in place for the Jews. And trials were supposed to be public during the day with ample time for defenses to be prepared. Well, that's not what we saw here. Jesus was grabbed in the garden, taken immediately to a trial in the middle of the night. There had to be at least two collaborating witnesses anytime there was a charge. And they had to have exactly the same story. One fellow I was listening to gave this example. He says, "Joe stole my cow. I've got two witnesses." So first one gets up and says, "I saw Joe steal his cow." The next one gets up and says, "I saw Joe steal his chicken." Dismissed. The stories aren't exactly the same. That was the way that God set it up in Deuteronomy. The leaders were not to defend or prosecute. In fact, once they had heard the cases, they were to actually wait a day and fast and meditate. Well, they couldn't very well do that Passover. They were in a hurry. Then the high priest stood up before the others and asked Jesus, "Well, aren't you going to answer these charges? What do you have to say for yourself?" But Jesus was silent and made no reply. Then the high priest asked, "Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?" And Jesus said, "I am. And you will see the Son of Man seated in the place of power at God's right hand and coming on the clouds of heaven." Jesus had remained silent through all the testimony. He had answered no charges. Maybe something to be learned here. Sometimes it's better just to remain silent than to lend any credence to what is being said. Well, finally, the chief priest asks this question, which again goes right against the Mosaic law. He's not supposed to be acting as a prosecutor. "Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?" Another way, perhaps, of interpreting what he said, he might have been saying, "Are you the one we've been waiting for? Are you the one who God promised he would send way back in Genesis?" Now, what an opportunity for a chief priest. Just think about that for a moment. He had the opportunity to be the chief priest who recognized the Messiah. As Jesus responded to him, "I am. And you will see the Son of Man seated in the place of power at God's right hand and coming on the clouds of heaven." Wow. Wouldn't you like the opportunity to recognize Jesus for who he is? Wouldn't you be excited to see the one who Israel has waited generations for? Instead, that's not what happened. We got denial. When Jesus responded that way, then the high priest tore his clothing to show his horror, and he said, "Why do we need any other witnesses? You've all heard his blasphemy. What's your verdict?" "Guilty," they all cried. "He deserves to die." Then some of them began to spit at him, and they blindfolded him and beat him with their fists. "Prophesy to us," they jeered, and the guards slapped him as they took him away. Now, Mark takes us on a little side trip here. Meanwhile, Peter was in the courtyard below. One of the servant girls who worked for the high priest came by and noticed Peter warming himself at the fire. She looked at him closely and said, "You were one of those with Jesus of Nazareth." But Peter denied it. "I don't know what you're talking about," he said, and he went out into the entryway. Just then a rooster crowed. When the servant girl saw him standing there, she began telling others, "This man is definitely one of them." But Peter denied it again. And a little later, some of the other bystanders confronted Peter and said, "You must be one of them because you're a Galilean." Peter swore, "Curse on me if I'm lying. I don't know this man you're talking about." And immediately, the rooster crowed a second time. Suddenly, Jesus' words flashed through Peter's mind. "Before the rooster crows twice, you will deny three times that you even know me." And then he broke down and wept. Now, we need to give Peter some credit. He was in this courtyard while the trial is going on in adjoining buildings. He hadn't deserted Jesus completely. He was trying to stay up with it and see what was going on. But when asked if he was one of Jesus' followers, he denied it three times. Loyalty? Well, here's some good news for you. Peter repented. He was forgiven, and he was used, as you know, mightily by God. I mean, he became a great speaker. See, God wasn't done with him yet. We should take comfort in that. When you're willing to come before God and be used, regardless of your past, regardless of mistakes, of sin, of human frailty, God will use you. He's not done with you yet. Very early in the morning, the leading priests, the elders, and the teachers of religious law, the entire high council, met to discuss their next step. They bound Jesus, led him away, and took him to Pilate, the Roman governor. While the Jews could govern themselves to some degree, there were limits. They did not have the authority to carry out capital punishment, and they so desired to be rid of this Jesus. Only the Romans could carry out capital punishment. So Jesus was taken to Pilate, the governor, for trial. Pilate was charged with keeping a lid on any kind of revolt. And that was the reason he was in Jerusalem at this time. This is the Passover. And some estimates say there are as many as 3 million people in this city that was built for a million. It was a condition that was ripe for revolutions, especially if emotions were riding high. Now, I don't think Pilate cared a great deal whether the religious leaders felt afraid of Jesus or wanted to be rid of him. That wasn't cause. He probably didn't even care that in the Jews' mind, or at least the religious leaders' mind, that he may have blasphemed the Jewish God. That didn't bother Pilate a great deal. Pilate was concerned about keeping the peace. So Pilate asked him a question. Pilate says, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus replied, "You have said it." Now, it's interesting that Pilate would say, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Because probably that's what the chief priest and those other leaders told him was the problem. See, king of the Jews sounds like, oh, this fellow is putting himself up above Caesar, up above the emperor. Here is potential for revolt. King of the Jews. Another way that you might translate Jesus' answer, that you have said it, is, if you say so. See, there had been many false messiahs who made that claim and they failed, who raised up revolts that the Romans had put down. Pilate had probably sentenced several to death. For the religious leaders to accuse Jesus as claiming to be king of the Jews placed him into that group of others who had raised up against Rome. For Jesus to answer yes to Pilate's query would have placed him on the same level as previous false messiahs. In other words, Jesus' response was the same as asking, "Who do you say I am?" You can see that caused Pilate some problems. "You have said it," Who do you say I am? It is you who are saying I'm king of the Jews. His accusers sense this, that their opportunity might be slipping away. So they started piling on accusations. Then the leading priests kept accusing him of many crimes. And Pilate asked him, aren't you going to answer them? What about all these charges they're bringing against you? But Jesus said nothing, much to Pilate's surprise. Again, sometimes silence is called for. Now, it was the governor's custom each year during the Passover celebration to release one prisoner, anyone the people requested. One of the prisoners at that time was Barabbas, a revolutionary who had committed murder in an uprising. The crowd went to Pilate and asked him to release a prisoner as usual. This custom was meant to be an offering to make the Jews think that Rome might actually concede something to them. In truth, the motivation was simply to hold down protest. And I think that in this question being asked to release somebody, Pilate saw an out. He knew Jesus was innocent. So he pulls up Barabbas, a murderer already condemned to die, an insurrectionist, one who had probably killed a government official in the insurrection. So Pilate figured, I will put up this worst of the worst, and I'll put up this innocent man, and I'll let the crowd decide, and surely they'll choose Jesus and let him go. Would you like me to release to you this king of the Jews? Pilate asked. For he realized by now that the leading priest had arrested Jesus out of envy. But at this point, the leading priest stirred up the crowd to demand the release of Barabbas instead of Jesus. I wonder if Barabbas ever pondered that he was the first guy in history that Jesus took his place. I'm guilty. He's not. He's dying for me. Pilate then asked him, then what should I do with this man you call the king of the Jews? They shouted back, crucify him. Well, why? Pilate demanded. What crime has he committed? But the mob roared even louder, crucify him. So to pacify the crowd, Pilate released Barabbas to them. He ordered Jesus flogged with a lead-tipped whip and then turned him over to the Roman soldiers to be crucified. So what is your notion of loyalty at this point? How did this cast of characters measured up when you ask these questions? How about some questions for you? How do you fit in? How do you define loyalty for yourself? Who do you give your loyalty to, and to what degree? Do you give it wholeheartedly to Jesus? Do you hold anything back? Does Jesus deserve your loyalty? T.F. Hodge is quoted as saying, one owes loyalty only to those who demonstrate in kind. Do you believe that Jesus has demonstrated in kind when he sacrificed his life as a payment for your sin? What kind of loyalty do you owe because of that kind of demonstration? One of my favorite devotions is My Utmost for His Highest by Oswald Chambers. And in one of his devotions, he asked this question: are you loyal to Jesus or loyal to your notion of him? Are you loyal to your notion? Do you try to fit Jesus into your system? Or do you want to fit into the call Jesus has for you? So who is this Jesus? Throughout our study of Mark, we have seen that the one we follow, Jesus, came as a servant. One who serves. He came to set an example of how we are to live, presenting us with a challenge to break out of those patterns of self-absorption and to give ourselves in service and love to others. He came to give us an avenue to God the Father. He came to serve us with his death so that we might live. So to whom do you give your allegiance? To what degree? Ponder that this week. Ponder the fact that Jesus Christ's death was a sacrifice, an atonement for all the sin that ever was and ever will be, for all of your sin. Ponder the fact that without that sacrifice, you have no avenue to God. That it took his death, his sacrifice to open the door so that you might have a relationship with Jesus Christ. Father, we thank you for sending Jesus, your Son, to show us how to live. We thank you that you sacrificed him on the cross that our sins might be forgiven. We know you hate sin. Father, may we see our sin as you see it. May we evaluate our lives and make changes with your strength to be more loyal to you. Thank you for being a God who loves us. Thank you for being loyal to us. How great you are. Amen.